facing elimination yesterday, Pete Alonso called game. Yes, welcome on in to First Pitch for Friday, October 4th, your home for news, notes, and updates on Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. You can follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. That's my man, Troy Brock. You can follow him on Twitter at Troy B Baseball. Similar naming convention. No, we're not siblings. And Troy, I want to get to some managerial hires and some coaching fires. I want to get to this weekend's divisional series matchups. But before we do all of that, as the resident Braves fan here, you're a Phillies fan. You actually host the Phillies podcast, Philly Faithful with a P. How annoying is this New York Mets team?
Man, they are pesky. And especially over the last month, they've really become more and more pesky as the season has gone on. And the Brewers faced the brunt of it yesterday. And earlier this week, the Braves faced the brunt of it. It's anytime they're down, you can't count them out. They are the comeback kids. I think in last night's broadcast, they said that the Mets are one of the two teams in baseball with the most comeback wins this season.
Yeah, so the New York Mets, down in their game three elimination winner go home game, it's scoreless into the seventh inning. You get back-to-back home runs from Jake Bowers and Sal Frelick. If I remember the stat right, Frelick's homer was his first since like May. It gets into the ninth inning. The Brewers have Devin Williams. They're, you know, the rookie of the year in 2020. They're two-time All-Star, two-time MVP finisher, him of 68 career saves, and unfortunately, he did not get number 69. Pete Alonso hits a home run, massive home run, and historic for a few different reasons. So, counting the postseason, Devin Williams has faced 967 batters. This is the seventh home run off of him by a right-handed hitter, but more significantly, the first opposite field home run in his career. It took 967 batters faced for someone to hit an opposite field home run off of Devin Williams. Also, the first home run off of his airbender changeup all season. What was more improbable? Francisco Lindor's ninth inning home run against Atlanta on Monday, or Pete Alonso's ninth inning home run off of Devin Williams on Thursday?
It could just be recency bias, but I'm going to say Pete Alonso's home run off Devin Williams. Devin Williams is one of the nastiest pitchers in the game, hands down. And it was, I mean, it was pretty clear from the first couple of plate appearances that he had last night that Devin Williams just didn't really have it, which is not something you see from him generally. And Pete Alonso took advantage. Pete Alonso and the Mets as a whole took advantage of it. And the first opposite field home run in almost 1,000 batters faced. That's absolutely insane.
Yeah, to not only do it, but do it the way he did, right? And you look at the Lindor home run on Monday. Atlanta had already used closer Rizal Iglesias. That was off of one of their setup men, Pierce Johnson. This is off of one of the best closers in baseball. Although this is an incredibly small sample size, but I find it really interesting how you have some guys who are really good in the regular season and in the postseason doesn't quite happen. Devin Williams in his career, again, 68 saves, 27-10 record with a 1.83 ERA in the regular season. In the postseason, he's 0-1, in three games, 2 1/3 innings, 6 runs allowed on 4 hits. It's a 23.14 ERA. Again, incredibly small sample size, only 3. But this is just one of those things that it's got to be frustrating for Brewers fans, knowing that you have this amazing closer that for some reason just seems to struggle in the postseason. And to know you were that close to moving on, and instead now you've been eliminated after winning your division pretty much wire to wire. It's part of me thinks this is kind of fluky, you can't really draw any giant conclusions off of this. Part of me thinks, well, this has now been a couple seasons where you've been eliminated pretty early in the postseason. What do you change to try to make a deeper run next year? I'm curious to see what Milwaukee does after this elimination.
Absolutely. Yeah. And really, you can't this season, you can't pin his struggles in last night's game on fatigue, because he didn't start the season until July. He only had 21 innings pitched in the regular season. So, you know, other seasons you might be able to pin it on fatigue a little bit, but not this season. So it could just been a fluke. I did see something floating around from John Boy Media where he may have been tipping his pitches last night. Mm-hmm. But it's crazy that a pitcher of his caliber has had no success in the postseason so far.
Yeah. And this, I mean, it's frustrating. Obviously, you look at one of those things where I would argue Milwaukee kind of outplayed New York this entire time. I mean, they had seven hits, obviously only two runs, seven hits, struck out nine times. You also look at the Mets, struck out nine times, but they only got five hits. Two of them were Francisco Lindor's. And then again, it's just that ninth inning, that's where Nimmo singles, that advances Lindor, then Alonso homers to bring in the three, and then Starling Marte gets an RBI single that scores another run. And it's just like all of those runs, or all those hits mostly, they had two hits going into the ninth. Like most of those hits come in the ninth inning, and that's just the team is clutch somehow, and we can't really measure clutch. We don't really have a way to quantify clutchness, but the Mets seem to have it, and so I'm really intrigued to see what happens in this upcoming series versus Philly, because they now move on. Game one in that series is scheduled for 4:08. Mets at Philly to start. Philly's announced Zach Wheeler is starting game one. As our resident Philly expert here, what are your thoughts on having to face the Mets in this matchup?
Well, being in the same division, the Phillies have faced the Mets 13 times. Wheeler, surprisingly enough, only made one start against the Mets this season. And in that start, he went seven innings, struck out eight. He allowed the Mets actually hit him pretty well. He gave up two runs in those seven innings, and I think the Phillies lost that game. But they hit 259, 286, 407 against Wheeler in that game and scored two runs. Playoff Wheeler is a completely different animal, and it's mm-hmm. going to be in Citizens Bank Park in Red October. It's the Mets, despite their coming back ability that they've showed of late, they struggled. As you said, they struggled in that game yesterday, and they struggled throughout that whole series against Milwaukee, and they're coming into Philadelphia to face even better pitching and an even better lineup. So I really don't think the Phillies have much to worry about as long as they have more than a 2-3 run lead in the ninth inning. I think the Phillies should be okay in the whole series.
Yeah, and you had the stat, I think, either in our First Pitch Discord or in the group chat that you, me, and Christian have. The only wins that the Mets have off of Philly all year were games in which Taijuan Walker started, and he's obviously not going to be starting games in the postseason. So, like, the confidence is warranted. Like, this is not just, we think we got lucky in the regular season, we have to worry about them. It feels like Philly has handled New York pretty handily this year outside of Taijuan Walker starts when he got blown up, and he's probably not even going to be on the playoff roster, I would assume. And if he is, it's at best a bullpen role. Speaking of postseason roster, reporting came out last night that the Mets are considering activating Kodai Senga for the NLDS roster. The decision is going to be he would be a bullpen guy only. He would be shorter outings. He threw a 25-pitch bullpen session earlier this week, something where he made that first start against Atlanta after shoulder issues, had a calf strain in that start, has been on the IL stint, was trying to come back late in the year, and had some tricep soreness. But they're considering activating him because he got through a bullpen session and because they've just ridden the reliever so much down the stretch. And we saw in that Braves game on Monday, game one, Edwin Diaz gave up the lead to Ozzie Albies in the eighth. And he's not been amazing here. Maton blew the lead and took the loss on Wednesday. Is activating Kodai Senga, you think, a good thing, a bad thing, or it doesn't necessarily matter because it won't be close enough where that is an issue?
I think it can help them. His ghost splitter is just nasty, and the Phillies haven't faced that at all this season. And I haven't looked to see if they faced him at all last season, but it just having that coming out of the bullpen could help. I don't think it's going to help enough to where the Phillies should have to worry about not moving past this series, but it's definitely a help for them. Like you said, they've used their bullpen a lot. Edwin Diaz has not been great. Even last night, he wasn't great. The Brewers just didn't capitalize on it, and he was very wild with nowhere near the strike zone with a lot of his pitches, and it was just something that the Brewers didn't capitalize on last night. Senga would be a good addition to their bullpen for the postseason.
Yeah, looking at the stats from 2023. He made two starts against the Phillies, went 1-1 with a 1.46 ERA, 4 runs, 2 earned on 6 hits, 3 walks to 15 strikeouts in 12 and a third innings. Now, obviously, the big question here is, what condition is he in? Is he as good as he was regular season last year? Or if he's a diminished version of that, how diminished is his stuff? Or is it just his stamina at this point? We don't really know, but be interesting to watch. Again, game one of that is 4:08 p.m. Eastern. Zach Wheeler starts for Philly. We do not know who the Mets starter is as of yet. The game will be broadcast on Fox. The other NLDS matchup is another divisional matchup. It is the late game, starts at 8:38 p.m. Eastern on FS1. Dodgers, Padres. Dylan Cease taking on Yoshinobu Yamamoto. Going to be really interesting to see what happens here. This is something these teams played, obviously, divisional rivals. They played a lot in the regular season. And I'm hesitant to say that San Diego wouldn't be favored in this simply because you have to think their pitching is in a better place than LA's because of all of the issues. LA has Jack Flaherty going in game two opposite Yu Darvish. Flaherty was really good after he got traded. His last couple starts, his ERA has been over 6 for LA. And then game three, which is tentatively scheduled for, I'm not tentatively, it is scheduled for Monday. We don't have official starters yet, but Walker Buehler is expected to be the starter there. We'll see what the Padres do. Obviously, they lost Joe Musgrove. We don't know if he'll be back or not. But who should be favored in this Padres-Dodgers matchup? Should this be the Padres as the favorite, despite being the lower seed and not having MVP Shohei Ohtani on their team?
I would say yes. They've been the hottest team in baseball outside of maybe only the Tigers in the last month. And as you said, the pitching for the Padres is much better than the pitching for the Dodgers right now, and strictly because of all the injuries that the Dodgers have faced this season. But the Padres have the better pitching. They have probably the best bullpen in baseball, and they have a deeper lineup than the Dodgers because the Dodgers – I'm not even sure. I haven't heard if Freddie Freeman's going to play or not yet. And really, it's Shohei Ohtani, Mookie Betts, and then it's just kind of a steady decline after those two. Whereas with the Padres, you know, you've got Jackson Merrill, Manny Machado, Fernando Tatis Jr., Luis Arraez, and the list just keeps going on before it starts declining.
Right. Yeah. And updates on those injuries. Freddie Freeman, I think it's a sprained ankle. Happened, I want to say September 26th. He was trying to beat out a play at first base. He turned awkwardly and tried to stop while he was kind of almost running sideways and sprained his ankle. Miguel Rojas is also injured. He has a tear in his left adductor, which he played through for a little bit, something where they would have gone to the injured list if not for the postseason. They are both rehabbing. The update from Dave Roberts as of Wednesday was that they're both, quote, they're progressing. The hope would be to get them both some live pitching probably tomorrow or Friday. It's something where I feel like Freeman I'm not as concerned about as I am with Rojas. Obviously, having an ankle sprain is not great, but at first base, I feel like that's the place where you're least likely to need the additional speed. Obviously, it does impact his base running ability, but he's there to hit. And he's there to make scoops at first base. He might not be able to range to make a bunch of plays, but he can still scoop at first base. Rojas is something where you can always throw Tommy Edman in there if you need to at shortstop. And Rojas offensively isn't the best option anyway, but I just, between that and the questions about the pitching, Yamamoto, how deep can he go? Which version of Flaherty is this going to be? Which version of Walker Buehler is this going to be? Buehler did take down the Padres in the last start against them. He allowed one run, I think it was five innings, but he also only got one strikeout and like three or four whiffs. So for me, it's got to be the Padres, even if they don't get Joe Musgrove back, simply because you still have Cease, you still have Michael King, you still have Yu Darvish. And like you said, the lineup just feels like it's a little bit deeper with guys that you trust later in games versus what LA has and how it's really been driven by the top three, those three former MVPs running the show up top. So I think I'm with you. I think I'm favoring the Padres in this, which is wild to think about going into the year when the Dodgers spent $1.4 billion, right?
Right, absolutely.
Okay, so moving on from the National League to the American League, the first matchup of the day on Saturday, 1:08 p.m. Eastern on TBS and True TV. I guess it's being showed on both of them. Tigers and Guardians, the third divisional rematch in this whole thing. The Tigers have not announced a starter. I don't really think that matters because they're not big into the whole starter thing other than other than Tarik Skubal. They don't really care about their pitching. They AJ Hinch called it chaos for game two against Houston. Tanner Bibee going for the Guardians, 12-8, 3.47 ERA on the year. Teams that have seen each other a ton in the postseason, how do you feel about when these teams match back up in the postseason? Who has the advantage? Is it the team that won in the regular season, or is it just whichever team has better momentum at the moment?
As far as that goes, I would probably say whichever team has better momentum at the moment is as closely as these two teams are on paper. The Tigers went 6-7 versus the Guardians in the regular season, and they have a lot of momentum right now. Yeah. And if last season and the season before that is any indication, the break, people like to say that the week-long break between playing makes their bats go cold. So if that takes place for the Guardians, then that's not really a good sign for them, even with Detroit throwing Captain Chaos in a few of the games.
Interesting note on that, 6-7 record against Cleveland this year, but a plus 10 run differential. They scored 60 runs against Cleveland. They allowed only 50. So some of those, you know, that run differential is obviously impacted a little bit by some close losses. They got walked off by Cleveland 5-4 back in May. They lost another one 2-1. But then, you know, they also had some dominant wins later. There was a 10-1 win in mid-July. So questions about it feels like a lot of the wins for Detroit were bigger than the losses. And given the momentum of Detroit, given some of the offensive frustrations we've seen from Cleveland this year, it kind of feels like maybe Detroit, between the momentum and all that, Detroit should be favored against the Cleveland Guardians, which is wild to think because this is, you know, the Guardians are number two seed and they clinched this whole thing rather early, which unfortunately also means they haven't had to play really competitive games in a little while. And like you said, they got that break. And last year, everybody but the Astros who had the break lost. I believe the Astros are actually the only team in the last two seasons who have had that break and then lost. Turns out they probably should have played a little better and had a break this year if they wanted to still be in the postseason.
Correct. The Guardians, I think they were the other team with the Mets that had the most come from behind wins this season. They had 42 come from behind wins. Ooh. And in one run games, they are 26-19. Which it helps when your closer is Emmanuel Clase. But
your bullpen in general is fantastic. But Emmanuel Clase is a giant part of that and should be a top five Cy Young finisher in the American League. Might not be because voters are weird, but should be, right?
Yeah. Oh, I agree.
Yeah. All right. The final matchup, the only non-divisional matchup, is Bobby Witt Jr. and the Kansas City Royals going to New York to take on the Yankees. Going to be really exciting. We have game one's matchup, Michael Wacha versus Gerrit Cole. That game's at 6:38 Eastern on Saturday. It'll be broadcast on TBS. They will get Sunday off, and they will turn around and play game two on Monday. That's already been announced as a lefty duel, Cole Reagans versus Carlos Rodon. Both teams would play again on Wednesday, and that's officially a TBD. So, Saturday, Royals at Yankees. How are you feeling about that?
I think that that is probably going to be the Yankees' best shot at winning a game with Gerrit Cole on the mound, just because, again, it's shaping up to be a postseason of upsets, Lindsay. Mm-hmm. And the Royals, in my opinion, the Royals have the better pitching staff than the Yankees, because the Yankees Ooh. Really have Gerrit Cole, and they have a really top-heavy pitching staff with Gerrit Cole at the top. But the Royals is more deep. The Royals have a deeper pitching staff, and the Royals have
feels like the lineup. Royals bullpen is more reliable.
Yeah. Just yeah, the Royals
Clay Holmes has not had it all year.
Yeah, the lineups kind of match up pretty well outside of Aaron Judge and Juan Soto. The Royals have, you know, Bobby Witt Jr., Salvador Perez, Vinny Pascantino's coming back, or he was back in the wild card series. Mm-hmm. So. Again, I think the Royals have a little bit deeper of a lineup than the Yankees. I think this is probably going to be the most evenly matched series of the divisional series round, but I'd still think the Royals are going to upset the Yankees when it's all said and done.
Interesting call there. The looking at the season record, Royals went 2-5, were outscored by 18 runs by the Yankees in those seven games. I do agree that it feels like the Royals, one, I think speed-wise, they definitely have an advantage over the Yankees as far as just speed up and down the lineup. This Yankee squad is not particularly fast. They don't really do a lot of base stealing. I don't really feel like they're even that good at running the bases. Mm-hmm. A lot of their thing is predicated on getting guys on so that Judge and Soto can drive them in. And if you can somehow contain Judge and Soto, which is easier said than done.
Absolutely.
If you can somehow either contain them or minimize the damage to just what they can do, you have a chance. But I do want to point out that in the month of September, nobody scored less runs than the Kansas City Royals. They had the least runs in all of baseball. The White Sox outscored the Royals. And yes, they didn't have Vinny Pascantino, but you saw in their two-game series against the Orioles, I believe they scored 3 runs in 2 games. And I do feel that outside of Corbin Burnes versus Gerrit Cole, it's a comparable quality of pitching staff for the Yankees and the Orioles. And so what I need to see is I need to see the Royals being able to score some runs, because we have not seen that since September came around. It's now been a full month of them struggling to score, and they've scored enough to win. I mean, they scored enough to still make the postseason. They scored enough to advance past the Orioles, but they've got to score enough to be able to take down a better offensive squad in the Yankees, one of the higher scoring teams of the season. And that's my concern, is that they're not going to be able to score enough runs to keep up with the New York Yankees.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. I can definitely see that. I think that game one is going to be very telling of how the series will go as a whole. Mm-hmm. Even with as tough as Gerrit Cole is, if they are able to even just string together some hits here and there and put up 1 or 2 runs against Gerrit Cole, I think that we'll have a better indication of where their offense currently stands and how they're going to fare against the rest of the Yankees rotation throughout the series.
Yeah. Okay. Jumping into this real quick, a little bit of coaching changes that we've seen. I want to start off with the hire before we get to it. Actually, no, let's do the fire first, because that's the sad one. Diamondbacks are changing up their pitching coaching trio. So pitching coach Brent Strom, assistant pitching coach Dan Carlson, bullpen coach Mike Fetters, quote, will not return in their current roles in 2025. The club did not announce any specific moves. They did confirm that reporting. So I believe this is all three guys are leaving. I don't necessarily know if they're going to get reassigned or something like that. Strom is now in his 70s, a little bit older. He's been there since 2022. Obviously, their pitching took a major step back this year. You could argue that the emergence of Brandon Pfaadt in the postseason last year is what helped them get to the World Series. Obviously, they were a little more healthy. They had Merrill Kelly, things like that. But the pitching, the Diamondbacks ranked 27th in the majors this year with a 4.62 ERA. And they had most of their starters miss time due to injury, as well as Jordan Montgomery, who signed after the season started, eventually lost his spot in the rotation. And you heard the owner talk about how that was a giant mistake to sign him in the first place because he sucked. And pretty much wanted him to not opt in. And if that's me, I'm opting in even harder after those comments.
Absolutely.
You're not getting rid of me that easily. But thoughts, like, is this an overreaction to one injury-filled year, or do you think this needed to happen?
I think it's an overreaction to one injury-filled year. When Bob Nightingale made the report about all of this happening, our boy Christian, he responded and said, "Why? It wasn't their fault. It was all Jordan or Montgomery, remember?" And so just wanted to shout Christian out with that tweet because that was pretty funny. But yeah, I think it was an overreaction. Because when you look at what Brent Strom did in just his body of work throughout his career, look at what he did with the Astros. They got Garrett Cole and turned him into a Cy Young contender. They got Charlie Morton, turned him into one of the best pitchers in baseball for a time.
Yeah.
Justin Verlander was already fantastic, and they made him even better. Just Brent Strom was able to turn around all of these pitchers who had the ability. They just needed to tap into it, and Brent Strom was able to tap into that ability. And I think, A, it's an overreaction, and B, I think that Zach Gallen might not be as good as everyone thinks he is from that hot stretch that he had where he was in Cy Young contention was last year or the year before that. I think that was just a really, really hot stretch for him and what he's been doing lately, which is still good. He's not bad. He's still a good pitcher. He's just, I don't think he's suited to be an ace on a World Series contending team, whereas he's more suited to be a two or a three. And I think that they put a lot of stock into that one hot stretch when they shouldn't have. And that has also been a big piece of it. I think it's an overreaction.
Yeah, it feels a little bit of you didn't necessarily have to go this far. Part of me wonders, is there something we don't know about? Is there other things off the field, things like that? But yeah, this feels like a bit of an overreaction. We'll see if this is a good move or a bad move. Next year, you're going to have Zach Gallen, you're going to have Merrill Kelly, you're going to have Eduardo Rodriguez, who should be healthy. You're going to have Jordan Montgomery, who should be healthy and have a full regular offseason. You know, Ryan Nelson, I think, will be back. Brandon Pfaadt. We'll see what happens. But it feels like even if you didn't change anything, just the health means they're going to be better next year. It'd be hard to think that this rotation is going to be as bad as they were this year simply for health reasons. So it's going to look like it was the right move to fire them, and I don't necessarily know if they had anything to do with this or not. So we'll see what happens there.
It's hard to pitch in that park, too. A few weeks ago, I looked it up. They're over, just combined over a game between both teams, there's over 10 runs scored a game this season at their ballpark. And it's not just the away team giving up all those runs. You know, it's the home team giving up some of those, too. It's hard to pitch in that ballpark.
That is absolutely wild. Other wild news, kind of surprising to me here. The Mark Feinstein of MLB.com tweeted and wrote a story on Thursday that Terry Francona is going to be announced as the next manager of the Cincinnati Reds on Friday. He's going to get a 3-year contract. This is something where was with your Phillies, was with the Red Sox, was with the Guardians, won 2 World Series with the Red Sox. Stepped down after last year with the Cleveland Guardians. I believe they missed the postseason completely. Rough year. They hired Stephen Vogt as a first-time manager. He took them not only to the postseason, but a bye as the 2 seed. And then, you know, Francona, 11 days after the Reds fired David Bell, they're bringing in Terry Francona. Are you a little surprised that this is Terry Francona and not Skip Schumacher getting this role?
Yeah, I am. I think it should have went to Skip Schumacher. I mean, not to take anything away from Terry Francona. He's right. had a fantastic career.
Tito, but
I think it should have been Skip Schumacher with their young roster. I think he would have been a better option to help develop their young roster better, because their roster is all 26 or younger, mostly, at least all the key members of their core. And Terry Francona with the Guardians last year went 76-86, and then they turn around with a new manager and win over 90 games and have the second best record in the American League and win the division handily. And he did take the Guardians to the World Series in 16. That's what I wanted to look up, because I couldn't remember if he was the manager then or not. But I think it should have been Skip Schumacher.
Yeah. Do we think that the fact that Terry Francona spent 1 year playing for the organization went in his 10-year playing career, 1987, playing first base, left field, and right field, he batted .227 with three homers in 102 games. Do we think only 219 plate appearances? He was not a everyday starter. Do we think that that mattered any, or is this just either they weren't ready to pull the trigger on Schumacher, or they think that they are farther along in a competitive window despite never finishing above third place under David Bell?
That probably could have played a little bit.
Yeah, because Tito feels like he's the manager you hire if you think you have the guys already. You just have to get them to coalesce and make a run, right? Like the Red Sox, they hadn't been able to get past the New York Yankees. He comes into Boston. They upset the Yankees in the ALCS, won a World Series, win another one 3 years later. And it felt like they had the team mostly already together. He just had to get them to coalesce and step up and win it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you there. I think that upper management just might not have as good of a grasp on the situation that they're in as they should. They do have a lot of good pieces, but I do think they still have a lot of development left to go to get there. Ellie De La Cruz really has to cut down on the strikeouts.
Mm-hmm. He does.
He can be one of the best hitters in the sport if he cuts down on the massive amount of strikeouts and really ups that plate discipline. Christian Encarnacion Strand, he's good. He needs to develop more. He hasn't had really any time in the major leagues, mostly due to injury, especially this year. Jonathan India, he really took a step in his development this year, but Terry Francona, like you said, he's really not a development guy. He's a guy that you get there to push you across that final step into the World Series.
Yeah, they haven't made the postseason in a full season since 2013. Outside of 2020, they made the postseason. They were second place in the division, but outside of that, they haven't been above third place since Bell was there. Haven't made the postseason in the full season since 13. And I do think the injuries played a big part of that. Matt McClain and Christian Encarnacion Strand are both going to the Arizona Fall League, which is incredibly unique to have guys who are already major leaguers go to the Arizona Fall League. That's usually a finishing school for prospects and things like that. But the team wants to get them playing time, wants to get them, help them catch up from missing some or most or all of this season in the case of McClain. And I think that decision makes sense if you look at the context of why you would hire a Terry Francona over a Skip Schumacher. And it's because we think this is a championship caliber roster as it's currently constructed, especially when you add in Rhett Lauder to your pitching staff with Hunter Green and Nick Lodolo and all of that. And that is why you would send guys to the AFL so that they can hit the ground running for 2025. Going to be intriguing to see what happens. And also going to be intriguing to see where Skip Schumacher goes now, because that was kind of, I don't want to speak for everybody, but that was kind of where I penciled him in. As soon as we heard he was not coming back, as soon as we heard that Cincinnati fired their coach, we're like, okay, that's, they're doing this so they can go hire Skip Schumacher. And so it's, you've got Skip out there. David Ross is still out there, and I think is probably going to get another shot to manage this year when everybody sees how the issues with the Cubs were not his fault. It's very easy to see they switched to Craig Counsell, and they still had some of the same issues, had the exact same finish they did last year. So curious to see what happens with Skip, but congrats to Terry Francona. Excited to see what he does, and just excited to see what this team can do next year and what feels like, a outside of the Brewers, a pretty winnable NL Central with a lot of teams that are kind of down right now based on historically where they've been or where they're capable of being.
Yeah, absolutely. I think their best shot next year will be a wild card spot because of the Brewers. The Brewers don't seem like they're going anywhere next season other than where they are now. And even with the wild card spot, they still will have to get past the Braves, who, you know, for your sake, would be healthy all next season, and the Phillies and the Mets. So it's going to be a fun season, no doubt, to see how the Reds do next year with Terry Francona at the helm.
Yeah, it'll be fun. All right, you guys enjoy the night off from baseball tonight. Obviously, the games are back tomorrow on Saturday. 4 games for the postseason there, 2 more on Sunday. We will be back on Monday. In the meantime, if you're listening on audio, do us a favor, leave us a 5-star review. If you're on YouTube, subscribe to the channel, hit the notification bell down below so you know when we drop a new episode. And either way, tell all your friends that you can go watch First Pitch every single day to find out what you missed from Major League Baseball yesterday. Until next time, this has been First Pitch.